And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John, you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
Let's see if I can hear anything.
Check, check.
I can hear you. Check. Can't hear me. That's not bad.
I am eating the microphone.
I used to tell that to people all the time, eat the microphone.
Oh, yeah.
So you teach. First, we should tell people who you are.
Yeah.
That would be good. Jordan Freed, comedian, movie maker, and teacher of podcasts.
Yeah, I would say that's kind of accurate. I don't teach podcasts as much these days. I am currently working as the operations manager at the Williams Center in Rutherford, New Jersey. And that's kind of like a full-scale art center with a 641-seat like vaudeville theater from the 1920s that had fire in the 1970s. And we kind of helped renovate it back to being used, all of the rooms in the building. There's 2 movie theaters downstairs. There's also like connected to the 641-seat theater. There's like a 400 to 500 standing room area behind that, so it can be up to 1,000. And then there's also like a little comedy club jazz cellar room. There's a book and record store. Ooh. So that consumes, I would say, 95% of my time.
Yeah, that's a full-time gig. So how you find a time? So comedy is where I wanted.
Comedy is my first love, and I'm shooting my comedy special, When the Edible Hits, on October 5th. In Kearney, New Jersey.
So it's When the Edible Hits, and your name is pronounced Freed.
Correct. It's but Jordan Freed, but I'm very often fried.
Okay, good. That's what I was. I was going there.
It is on brand. It is in my DNA to be a little baked here and there.
I just started.
Oh yeah.
Well, so I'm married.
Yeah.
And I was like 40 and had never done pot at all, and we were thinking about having a kid.
Yeah.
So. And my wife had never done it either. So I said, hey, we have a friend who's a chef. So I said, hey, let's just ask him to set us up. So he said, when you get home, there's going to be a bag in your back door. And you have a pipe, right? Because I used to smoke a pipe.
Yeah.
So he's like, okay, you're all set. So he leaves the bag. I come in. And me and my wife sit down. It's a Saturday night. Now, you ever smoke a regular pipe?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you can go through a bag of tobacco in a night if you're just sitting there chilling. I didn't know that you didn't smoke pot the same way.
Oh, no, definitely not.
I did the whole bag with my wife. I lost the whole next day and like half the day after that. And then I called him up and I was like, what the fuck? And he's like, well, how much did you smoke? I'm like, I smoked the bag like I was supposed to. And he's like, that's like a month worth of pot.
Yeah.
That you did in like a day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, not cool at all, man. But and so then I didn't do any at all. But I could at least tell my daughter I tried it and what it is. And then I just started doing edibles like at night recently.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did like – one edible I didn't like made me like a little jumpy, but then another one was – because there's like 2 kinds, right? There's
sativa and indica.
Yeah.
Indica is more like sleepy, body high.
Yeah.
And then sativa is like energy, like I'm going to go to a party. I'm going to talk to somebody for hours.
Right. I think I like the indica better.
Yeah.
Definitely
different vibes, yeah.
And do you do it like daily?
Oh, yeah.
I imagine that.
Definitely to sleep.
Yeah.
And then usually some time before I sleep as well. And I usually smoke sativa.
No, okay.
It's kind of like good for depression.
Do you have depression?
Yeah.
Do you have you been diagnosed or is it just?
Yeah, I was on like Lexapro for a while.
Oof.
And kind of quit that cold turkey, which was odd, and then I wrote a novel. But
is that true?
I did. It's not out anywhere.
I was on Lexapro, quit it cold turkey, and then started a podcast.
Yeah, it kind of makes you do some manic, wild things if you get off it like cold turkey.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've kind of just self-medicated, and yeah, I think I have my mental health at a decent place now. Yeah.
Do you work out?
I try to. My job is very physical.
Oh, okay.
And like, it's a lot of like night shifts and then coming in for morning shifts type things. So it's hard to go to the gym because I'm a morning gym guy, but sleep, I feel like, is more important sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially when a lot of my job is like picking up chairs, moving tables, moving furniture, just walking around this massive building. Yeah. Like, sometimes during shows, I'd walk like 10 miles. Like throughout the building.
Wow.
Like I'm looking at my Apple Watch.
Right, so you do work out. You just get paid to do it.
Yeah, a little bit.
So what was behind the decision to get off Lexapro? You just didn't like it?
Yeah, I think I forgot it one weekend when I was out of town and didn't take it for a weekend. And then I was just like, well, I didn't take it this weekend. I might as well just not take it. It was good in some ways. I didn't really give it too long of a try. Like I think I did it for like 3 months maybe.
Right.
But yeah. I kind of just got off it. Yeah.
You ever do lithium?
No.
Oh, I was on lithium.
Yeah.
Because I was suicidal.
Okay.
But the lithium was turning toxic. Some people, lithium becomes poison, and I was one. And I like, sorry, listener, you can fast forward if you know the stupid story. I was batshit crazy too, but I could feel it. Like I could feel it was hurting me. So I told everybody in my life, like, I'm just going cold turkey. I'm just quitting cold turkey. And, like, everybody's like, you're crazy. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm still going cold turkey. And I did – I was Lexapro, lithium. There's one that started with an R. I was on, like, seven. And I just went cold turkey on all of it. And it was, like, a month and a half of hell, man. But it was worth it because that stuff – and I think – I love now that people are more open to alternative – treatment for depression, and we don't run right to the pharmacy right away. Not that for some people it's not valuable. It's valuable, but I like that we aren't – I like it's not our reflex.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean? I think for stability, it's like a very good tool.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you start in comedy?
I kind of auditioned for my school's talent show when I was 16, didn't make it. I auditioned when I was 17, did make it. Did the talent show at my high school, went pretty well, started doing open mics, wasn't really going well, but open figured it out in hard, like 6 months. Yeah, started doing some paid gigs like by the end of high school, and then did a festival before I went off to college. And then while I was at college at Tulane University, I was in their sketch group, which was Etch-a-Sketch, and then it changed over to Cap Mafia Comedy, and now it is like Office Hours Comedy.
Cool.
They were a sketch group that was awesome, and I kind of got to write on a regular basis, act on a regular basis. We did 2 semester shows a year, and then sometimes some pop-up shows in festivals or other places. And then I was still doing stand-up while I was in New Orleans when I wasn't partying and learning a little bit at college. And working in the film industry while I was down there. And then I moved back and have been doing it ever since in different ways.
You write regularly?
Not as much as I'd like to, especially now that I'm preparing for my special. It's kind of like get everything else right now. Like I should be writing for sure, but I'm kind of like not too focused on generating new material because like I got to get this special out. And like every time I do stand up, like normally when I do stand up, I'm like trying to do new stuff almost every time I go up. But since I'm recording this, I want to make sure inside and out, like make sure I'm going to see new audiences and trying every joke and cycling through kind of like the tracks of the album.
Right, right.
That's eventually going to come out.
How long is the set?
I have like over an hour of material right now. I'm going through the process of like battle testing it and cutting it down with stuff that just doesn't feel right.
Right.
And then, so I'll probably shoot something from like hopefully 45 minutes to an hour and then cut it down probably to 30 minutes to 45 minutes. We'll see how it all comes out. Like if I like all of it, then it's all going on it.
Yeah.
But I would assume there's going to be some edits made after the fact, kind of give people the special who are there and see everything and then have the final cut be something that's really reflective of what I want the kind of permanent record to be.
Right. Is it and then you shop it once you're done?
Yeah, that's the plan. I'm self-producing it. I got some homies. My friend Juan and my friend Angel are going to be kind of heading up the production. And then my friend Joe Kelly is going to be heading up the audio production. So I kind of got a team of like very trusted people who do this all the time and are kind of at the beginning of certain parts of their career and very advanced in other parts of their professional careers in this. And right. Yeah, it's going to be at a ballroom space in Kearney called Sesh House Social at 155 Midland Ave. And it kind of has like a weed cafe downstairs and then Perfect. Upstairs is a ballroom.
And how do we get tickets?
You can get tickets at lnhstudios.com/when the edible hits.
Okay.
Or you could do latenighthump.com/when the edible hits. Late Night Hump is my comedy group and production company that is known as LNH Studios. And we've kind of been producing stuff for the past 4 some odd years, probably really since 2018, 2019. I was collaborating with those folks in the Late Night Hump group, Rena Ezra and Brendan O'Brien.
Do you, and you're just shooting one, it's just shooting one set? You're not shooting?
Just shooting one set. I was going to do 2 sets, but the room's way too big. So I'm just doing 1 show.
Okay.
So that I get everybody to go to the one
right,
show.
Right.
So, yeah, there's pressure definitely to get it all right on the first try. But a lot of these jokes I've told literally probably thousands of times. Like right. Some of these jokes, like there's some jokes that are 11 years old and there's some jokes that are 4 months old. So it's a good combination of like generating content still at this point, like
right.
on the low level and then on the high level of how long the content's been in my rotation. Like I am in such a different place in my life than when I wrote these jokes. So I kind of just want to get rid of them and say I did write these jokes and I was performing them at a point in time in history, like the right. last decade and change. Right. So
it's yeah. funny because I'm a musician.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to what you do, but it's very, very different.
Like, oh, for sure.
And I think one thing that comedians do better than musicians is they understand the space between – they understand how to work the space between the jokes.
Oh, for sure.
They, there's a whole pace to it. Whereas musicians, I feel, kind of drop the ball on that a lot when you're performing out. You know, what you say in between the songs and what you do in between the songs, it to me is as important as what you're doing during the songs. And I think comedians understand that because a good – comedy set, tell me if I'm wrong, but a good comedy set is completely rhythm based.
100%. Yeah.
Okay.
I love jazz music and I feel like each set is kind of just like it's jazz, you know. Sometimes you go faster, sometimes you go slower, but you gotta feel the room and like really know what the rhythm you want to be at. And like it's a lot of like going back and forth between rhythms,
right?
You know, like you don't want to keep doing the same rhythm the whole show. So it's also like figuring out how to be funny in different rhythms because
right.
like anybody, like Jerry Seinfeld has a very similar rhythm for almost every single one of his jokes.
Right.
You know, and it's a formula that works and he's a legend and a goat of stand-up. But also at the same time, if you want to be unique, I feel like you really got to create your own style. So I'm trying to not have all the jokes be exactly the same because like I started out more of like a Mitch Hedberg kind of like one-linery guy, which is very easy to be rhythmic.
Stephen Wright. Stephen Wright.
Yeah.
Because I was watching your stuff and I'm like, that's almost Stephen Wright pace.
For sure, yeah. I didn't get into Stephen Wright like super early into stand-up, but after I was like, very similar to Mitch Hedberg at times because like he's one of my favorite comics of all time. It kind of just happened that people were like, oh, you're like Stephen Wright, which Mitch Hedberg is like Stephen Wright. So that probably makes sense.
Right.
I think that's the direct lineage probably. I don't know for a fact. I guess I got to look up some Mitch Hedberg biographies.
Do you, when you do the set, is it the same sequence every time?
No, definitely not.
It's not.
No. That's definitely the jazz of it, too.
Okay.
It's like, I definitely feel in the moment, at least when I'm doing like 10 to 15 minute sets, right. Like I'll kind of go up there with like a general idea with what I want to do. But like now that I've built like over an hour of material, I'm kind of like, all right, I'm just going to gauge it out. Like, how should I start this set? Like, what is the level of like familiarity these people have with me? What is their reaction so far to the rest of the audience? If I'm later on a show, if I'm early on the show, it's like you got to hit them hard early, because if they're not laughing, they're never gonna laugh. Right. But like if the crowd is pretty warm, then you can kind of start the set in a different place.
Right.
For the special, I kind of have an order for it though.
Okay, that's what I was gonna.
That would be ideal to keep to that order, but I am resigned to the fact that in the moment I might switch things around a little bit, as long as I get everything out of the way.
Yeah, it's funny because the oldest joke in your set is how old?
There might be stuff that is 13 years old.
Okay, this is so I admire people that can do this, like with musicians. Like if you have a song that's popular,
yeah,
you have to keep doing it for years. But with comedians, if you have a joke that's popular, once it's out there on a special, it's done, right?
For sure. That's another reason why I want to get this special out there, because I'm like kind of ready to move on from this era of my comedy. Like I'm about to be 30, so I'm trying to get that like 20s and teens comedy like out of my system, put it out there. Hopefully, like, I don't know, it would be cool to be able to play some colleges. For many reasons, like I do think a lot of learning and education and arts happen on university campuses, but also they pay you the big bucks to play colleges as a young comic and an up and coming comic.
Right.
And then also like college students grow up. So it's just like, you got to get the fans young and then they follow you for the rest of their lives. Yeah. Like, it's funny, people, I go to NIAC a lot for open mic shows, and I've been there. I've been to Maureen's to do a bunch of open mics. I've been to Olive's. I do shows there. I actually have a show this Friday, September 27th, at Olive's in NIAC, and it's kind of like a rock and comedy show called Screams and Laughter.
Who's doing the rock?
There's some metal bands on it, I think. Oh, cool. I forget the bands off the top of my head. I'm kind of the comedic booker of the show, and this guy Tim McMurtry is kind of in that hardcore metal world, and was in a band that was pretty good back in the 80s, and he's kind of doing a bunch of production stuff with his shows. So I kind of come on because he likes comedians, and we've been producing some shows.
What was your biggest bomb?
Biggest bomb? That's a good question. There are bombs that I have perceived as big bombs, for sure. Like, there have definitely been some open mics that have been pretty bad, like trying new stuff and then jumping ship and being like out of the game, so I didn't have stuff to go to.
Right.
Those were pretty bad. I've had times that comedians have come up to me and been like, oh buddy, that was rough, when I didn't even think it was that rough.
Oh, that's nice.
And I was like, how do you guys interpret your own sets? But those have happened a couple of times. Right. One time, the vinyl room, that happened. Like, I thought I did okay given the crowd that I was doing it for, but like the guy who another guy who was on the show, he was just like, buddy, what was that? Like,
oh, fuck off.
Yeah, but it's like, I don't really give a shit because, like, once again, like, people are insecure about themselves and then do that. It's like, I know people have come up to me and said they like my set, you know?
Right.
Not everybody might like my set, but enough people like my sets, and like, I've been the person that gets the crowd alive during open mics for me to know, like, oh, I have something. And yeah, I'm excited to kind of move into this headliner phase of my comedy career, because I've been doing it a long time, and it's like, that's really the only way that you could make money as a comedian, if you're like actually doing comedy. Like, you have to be able to build an audience and like sell out theaters, and there's not really that opportunity. Like, you have to be so good and have such a huge following to do that. More than anything, I just want to be a guy that just gets on Brooklyn shows, has a couple of clubs that let me get up on a regular basis, and then keep shooting specials, go on tour a few times. That would be cool and ideal, and then kind of act after that.
Right. Where are you on? So open mics are they're fucking tricky.
For sure.
And they're I have mixed feelings about them for music, because but comedians, tell me if comedians have this problem. Like my open mics for musicians are good and bad. They're good because you have to have a place to learn how to work a room, right?
For sure.
And it's not you can work on your music and comedy are different in that you can work on your performance alone with music, right? Comedy,
yeah, 100%.
Comedy, you can't. Like I can practice for 4 hours, but you need people. So open mics are necessary to have that element. But then for musicians, what happens is you have a venue, and the venue hosts an open mic, and they don't have to pay anybody.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And then you go try to get a paying gig, and the venue's like, well, why would I pay when I just throw an open mic up there and have people go for free?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
That happens in comedy, too?
Yeah, I'd say there's a big aspect of that. I'd say the majority of comedians are pretty amateurish, so also that's the thing I think that's different. Like, either you can play the song that you want to play or you can't play the song that you want to play.
Right.
A lot of the times, and I think comedians always need to be kind of working on their craft until they're professional.
Right.
And, like, professional level comedians don't go to open mics like real ass professionals. They get on shows all right. week and go up like four times a week a couple of times like the clubs and stuff like that to test their material.
But a venue that's going to give you an hour set, right?
Yeah.
You're not competing with an open mic at that.
Correct, right now.
Right.
And yeah, but that's kind of the thing is like anybody who's ever had an open mic at their establishment has to see that like the quality is bad. You can't censor people. So like you think like, oh, I'm getting free entertainment, but like really you might alienate like people from your venue if you don't like have good people organizing the mic. Like there's kind of a self-policing aspect to the comedy world. Like if the host of the show like kind of set these limits and boundaries that it's not going to be okay for you to say really misogynistic stuff or say really homophobic stuff or say really racist stuff that like if you say jokes that have like gender politics in it or have racial conversations in them, that's like fine. But like I think sometimes people go crazy with the shock humor at open mics and might not be the best comics, and then all of a sudden they're the first comic because they just got there early because they don't have a job, and then all of a sudden the entire crowd is walked by the third person who goes up.
Right. Thanks for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like I think creating an environment where the comedians can be comfortable and like you set it up for comedy. Like you make people feel like they're going to laugh the whole show. Like if you're a host, you got to do like at least 5 minutes of material that like gets people going.
Set the temperature.
Yeah. From cold to hot. Like you have to get at least the crowd to bump with laughs once. If you don't get them to laugh once, you've failed 100%.
Right.
Like you shouldn't be expected to kill as a host every time because you're the first person on stage and they're all cold. They haven't drank their drinks. There might not even be drinks sold. So you're going to a sober crowd. But
I make a point to never do that.
Yeah.
The other difference with comedy and music, how do you build a life being a professional comedian? Because
it's hard
because you're touring, right? And touring like musicians, like here in the Hudson Valley, I can play out 5 nights a week and still go home
because
there's a gazillion venues. But for comedy, that's not necessarily true. And so you have to travel. And
yes and no. Like they're kind of what you're saying, within an hour of me, there are probably thousands of places to do comedy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you could make a living and stay put.
Because, like, New York City, there's
tons
of clubs. Then, like, I can whip up here in, like, an hour and a half or less from Rutherford, New Jersey.
Right.
Like, still have, like, my family lives in Warwick, New York. Then also, I know like Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Like I have connects out there. Like okay. I go out to Philly sometimes. So like there is an aspect. Yeah, there is an aspect that you could kind of be like a small road comic that has like a perimeter of 2 hours or less, and like. I think that's pretty doable.
That's cool.
In the local aspect, like a comedian's goal, I think on the local level should either be performing at a club that actually pays well multiple nights a week or just having residencies.
Right.
You know, like kind of what you were saying about like, oh, people could get just open mics for free. It's like I had a friend of mine, I think it was Jody Lee, who is like Upper Hudson Valley comic. Who hasn't been doing a lot of comedy lately, but she was a big character in the Hudson Valley scene, especially like in my upbringing in the scene. But she was like, never do an open mic if they're not going to pay you $100. It's going to be so much of a headache. Like you're offering them possibly 20 people who are going to buy one drink each.
Right.
Like the least they could do for paying somebody to bring their own equipment, host and be there from the start to finish, be there from early to end, make sure everybody is paying, making sure everybody is tipping, making sure everybody is behaving and like cultivating this crew of people who are going to come out. But down in Jersey, people will all just do open mics for free. And then there's too many open mics. And then all of a sudden people don't go to the open mics because there's too many. And then there's too few.
Right.
So there's a lot of that stuff going on down where I am.
And that's it.
And a lot of, I think, the Hudson Valley open mics for comedy have become sparse as well.
Yeah.
Like the scene's kind of become fragmented because like when you're so close to New York City, so many people don't want to actually build their own thing in their own local scene. They kind of want to just go into the city and be a part of that wave of lottery tickets and casino games that is like doing comedy in New York City. Like if you do comedy in your local scene, like you're actually building something, a fan base, a culture in that area of the country. But if you go to New York City, like chances are you're just minimizing your impact and you're just going there to say like, oh, when I go out to New Mexico, I could say I'm a New York comic. Like when I go out to Wyoming, I could say I'm a New York comic. Like if I say I'm a New York comic, that means I'm good. And like there's so many people who move there and then they just take that as ownership. But like as somebody who grew up so close to New York City and like went into New York City as a young comic and like went through all of the scams of New York City comedy. Like I'll do a bunch of shows in New York City that are like indie shows. Like I'll bounce around all the five boroughs, you know?
Right.
I don't do a lot of Bronx shows though. So if people book Bronx shows, get me on those, but love going to Queens, love going to Brooklyn, love going to Staten Island, go to Manhattan, of course. But ideally I'd like to be at the clubs cause like the clubs are what pay allegedly.
Right.
Allegedly.
the other thing with open mics too, it because you brought up a point that venues want to know how many people you're bringing and blah blah. That makes me crazy, but especially if you're using an open mic and because people are at open mics because they aren't drawing people yet. So the answer of how many people you're drawing with an open mic is zero. Because if I could draw people, I wouldn't be open micing.
Yeah, for sure. I think in like I lived in New Orleans for 4 years for college.
Yeah.
And like the open mic scene there was amazing because they would have like neighborhood bars that would say it's just comedy night. And then the comedians would know that it was an open mic and they would all sign up and get 3 minutes.
Right.
But there would be packed audiences on Monday nights at 12 Mile Limit. There would be mad audiences at Carrollton Station on a Wednesday night. And it's like that culture was super cool in New Orleans because there were some shows that were on weeknights, but there was no club down there when I was down there.
Right.
So it was all just the comedians self-producing and trying to make the scene themselves. And yeah, if you put importance into the open mic and you put culture into the open mic and say the best comics in the city are going to come to the open mics, then it's relevant. If the best comics don't come to your open mic, then it is just amateur hour and you're like, why am I watching amateurs when I could watch professionals?
Right.
So I think that's always the good balance. And something like as a 12-year-in comedian, I'm like, okay, I could always bring an asset to the open mic because like I may not be the best comic in the world, but I've done it 12 years and I'm going to put on a decent show every time and like know how to do an open mic and know how to get the crowd going. If like every single person is bombed before me, I'm like, I'm excited for that. I'm like, okay, it's my time to do this. If everybody else is bombed before me, like I got this.
I would imagine it's harder to write a 3-minute set than it is to write an hour set?
No. Well, like, you're more.
With 3-minute set, you're joke telling.
For sure. And also, like, most of the time when you're doing 3-minute sets, you're, like, relatively amateur. And if you're not amateur, you're at a place where you should just do a bunch of 3-minute sets. So it's like, oh, I'm doing a chunk here, a chunk here, a chunk here. Like, if you do 10 3-minute sets a week, that's a 30-minute set if you're doing different stuff every time.
Right.
And there's tons of comics who just do the same 5 minutes every single time. And it's like...
That would be hard.
Yeah, it definitely gets boring. And definitely when you're doing open mics for your peers who have seen you at other open mics.
Right.
And that's also what's hard about, like, staying local is, like, one of the reasons I, like, took the job in New Jersey was because I was working at a brewery in Monroe, New York, and I was driving up from Rutherford, New Jersey and stuff every single day. And my car was starting to break down. So then once I got this job, I was like, oh, I can't be driving all the time. So, like, I try to hit the mics that are close to me, but right. It's like the same fans, the same bartenders, the same comics go to the same mics a lot of the time. Like, there's some variance, but if I'm telling a joke that's 7 years old, chances are almost every single comic in the room has seen it unless they're a new comic.
Right.
So if there's a bunch of new comics in the room, I'll be like, oh, I'll prove that I'm a good comic. Like, watch all this stuff that I wrote when I was your age.
I asked this of musicians. I've never asked it of a comedian. What percentage of what you do is performative versus content-based?
Oh, that's a good question. A lot of it's writing. I would say most of it's writing.
So mostly content-based.
Yeah, I've always been kind of a joke teller on stage. Like, comedy has always been a means to be a writer, to be honest.
Right.
Like, I definitely don't think writing is as much of my passion as it used to be. Like, I just don't get as much joy thinking about writing as I used to. But I always thought that would be how I would become a TV writer or screenwriter, and like I still have ideas that I want to write screenplay wise but I think I've shifted more into liking the acting aspect of it. And like, for sure, with jokes, you are like a monologuist in a lot of ways. Like, there are a lot of comedians who interact with the crowd and they make that their bread and butter, but that's not really who I am as a comedian. I'm definitely more of an old school comic where it's like, I am here to tell my show.
Right.
And like, I want you guys to react to the show. Your laughs are your reactions. Like, I don't really want to talk to you guys. Like, don't throw me off my set. Just keep watching and enjoy. Like, you guys paid money to see me. You didn't pay money to hear me talk to Joe over there who fucking is a plumber and is going to tell me about some leaky drain. And then it's like, why am I listening to Joe the plumber's story? Like, I came here for this guy on stage. Like, it's kind of saying you're not that interesting, I think, if you're talking to the crowd all the time.
Well,
you're like, oh, let me generate content from you guys because, like, I didn't do anything to prepare for this. Let me see what – oh, say something. To me, oh, that's what you do. Cool.
Who's the guy? He just did a complete Netflix special. And it was all crowd work.
Matt Rife.
Yeah. Did you like that?
I did not watch it. I watched a little bit of his last special before that.
I'm a big comedy fan, so I watched it.
Yeah.
And so the idea behind crowd work is, as I understand it, is it's supposed to be spontaneous.
For sure.
Right.
There is spontaneity. When you don't do it every single show and release every single clip and let everybody know that you're going to be doing crowd work and people are coming to the shows with stories in their back pocket that they want to tell.
That's exactly what this was.
Yeah.
And it was so scripted that I totally took this. I didn't care for it. It was like – it was so scripted. And you could see he had like half dozen talking points that he was going to hit on, which is not crowd work. And the people from the audience that he worked with, you could tell were all pre-screened and all, it just wasn't my thing. Man, what was the novel about?
It was kind of a dystopian satire comedy called The Perfect Future.
What's the funniest book you ever read?
Funniest book I ever read. I think it would probably be a tie between How I Became Stupid by Martin Page.
Okay.
He's a French novelist.
I don't know that one.
I actually tried to acquire the rights to write a script for that film or to make a film, but somebody else has the rights. So maybe if
that's
I get
not prohibitive, let's make a deal.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't want to play ball because I'm broke. But maybe if I had a manager or agent who was doing it on my behalf, that would work better. But that book is hilarious. And then also I love all Vonnegut. Like I think Vonnegut is just hilarious. And then I also love The Disaster Artist, if we're going nonfiction.
Okay.
The book by Greg Sestero about the making of The Room and his relationship with Tommy Wiseau. And, like, that was the book that I probably laughed out loud to the most ever reading.
You make films, too.
Yeah, for sure.
Is it – so multi-talented. Is it – do you ever struggle with, like – the idea of doing a lot of things means I can't get as good as I could possibly be at any one?
Yes and no. Like, I think there's definitely not enough time in our lives to do everything that we want to do, and that's definitely the economy of your time and what you decide to work on.
Right.
But at the same time, I think you kind of go through ebbs and flows. Like, I'm really working hard on stand-up right now and have kind of neglected the other areas of my creativity, like improv, sketch comedy, filmmaking, and stuff of that nature. So I'm kind of resigned to the fact that once October 6th hits, I'm kind of switching up my life and I'm not going to be staying out late as much at open mics as frequently as I am right now. Like, it'll probably be like, I know Monday nights I could hit 3 open mics in a night, so I might go up those nights or something like that.
Improv is so fucking hard. I've did some.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so hard because it's so dependent on, well, when you're doing it with people.
Yeah.
Can you riff on like a topic improv? Are you that type of comedian? Like I can say water bottle and you can do 2 minutes?
I don't do that a lot, but I could. Like I definitely have an improv brain just from my years of training and stuff like that.
I so don't, because with improv, like you get, like I'm talking about the improv where you get a situation and it's you and me in a room and if I suck, I'm killing you. And you can't – and, you know, normally you could – as a comedian, you could start rolling your eyes and making fun of me and go that route. But in that scenario, you can't. I always struggle with that, because when I was with good people, it was great. But you get somebody that's not having the best night and it just sucks.
Yeah. I'd say the only wrong thing to do in improv is not listen. Because, like, there's really nothing wrong you could say because it hasn't been written before.
Right.
And, like, even if you're not getting what your teammate is putting down, as long as, like, what the script that is followed before makes sense with what you're saying.
Right.
Like, there are wrong things to say in improv. Like, if you just say something totally random that has nothing to do with the scene. But it's all about connecting to, like, what has been already set up. So I think it's
Your partner wants to take it in a different direction, and that direction isn't working, and you're, like, trying to veer it this way, and they aren't – like you said, they're not listening, and they aren't going.
Oh, yeah. You always have to give way to your scene partners because, like – it is what came before. So, like, if you negate something that came before and then they negate something that came before, all of a sudden you have lost the reality and you've lost any sense of, like, movement in the scene.
Yeah, and there's no line. There's nothing to follow anymore.
Yeah, that's why you gotta just yes and.
Where are you on integrating politics into your comedy?
There's a little explicit political stuff that is definitely commentary on political issues. And then I'd say, like, otherwise my politics kind of just come out of, like, what the content of my material is.
Right.
Like, I try to not be too forward with politics, especially because, like, I don't even like the parties. Like, I'm pretty disaffected by politics right now as somebody who used to be very into politics. But
what got you disaffected?
Oh, just the fact that all of my values are represented by the Democratic Party, but they just have no reason to actually be better and like listen to what the people say whatsoever. Because there's only one option for women's rights, because there's only one option for gay rights, because there's only one option for expanding of Social Security and expanding of, like, benefits that I believe, like Medicare for all. Like, I think that the Democrats should be pushing Medicare for all.
I don't know why they're not.
But yeah, so they don't have to actually do good things because they're just like, well, the Republicans will never do Medicare for all. So as long as we're not the Republicans, we could do that.
Right.
And I do think that there is some, like, I don't know, the media, like, consolidation of all the conglomerates, like, they own all the news networks, and then the news networks aren't actually reporting news, it's just commentary, so then that's what everybody's being fed. And then, like, conservatives think that everybody wants to turn all of your kids into trans kids and wants them to have babies and then have abortions, and, like, that's not even, like, day-to-day life as, right, like, a leftist. And, like, I know a bunch of people who have come into my job and said, I'm voting for Trump. Do you see what they're doing? She's going to turn us into what countries do they say she's going to turn us into? Fucking Argentina. Like, yeah, she's going to turn us into Cuba. She's going to turn us into this. She's going to turn us into that.
Right.
And I'm like, I wish she was a communist. She's not a communist. She is a capitalist. And, like, she's going to be good for business because she's going to end up giving corporations an easy ride. And, like, everything's going to be the same that it always is.
Right.
She's just like Joe Biden, and Joe Biden's just like George Bush, and George Bush is just like Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton is just like George H.W. And, like, maybe Jimmy Carter differs a little bit. Maybe Obama differs a little bit.
Right.
Jimmy Carter probably has become more leftist since he's left politics and left the actual Oval Office. Like, now he has very good takes on literally everything.
Right.
As, like, a 99-year-old in hospice. He somehow has better takes than all of our presidential candidates who are, like, 20 years younger than him.
Wisdom, man. It's wisdom.
For sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, after, like, the Bernie situation and just seeing how even people who were fans of Hillary, like, they weren't about the issues or the content. Like, they were just about, like, this person is supposed to be next. This person is supposed to be next. She's earned it. And, like, she did earn it. She did earn the right to be president. Like, she did have a very illustrious career in politics. But if people don't like her and they like somebody else, and their reasoning for liking somebody else is because they want everybody to have healthcare guaranteed, like, I don't think you should be cursing out people and disaffecting people. And then even this year, the Democrats put somebody into the presidency that didn't win a primary ever. So
right,
that's not really democratic. And they said that Donald Trump was a threat to democracy, and they didn't even let their party decide
right
who they wanted to be president.
That had to be part of the deal when they sat with Biden in a room.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure.
He,
it's his legacy. Well, if she's president. Yeah.
And I bet I they won't tell you she was in the room. I bet she was in the room. And the deal was, Joe, you got to step down. Joe says, okay, but then it's got to be Kamala. And then he says to Kamala, and you got to pardon my son. I said I wouldn't. I didn't say you wouldn't. You got to pardon my son. That has to be the deal.
Oh, I wonder.
I bet. I saw, you know, it's so funny. You're talking about the media. I saw it this morning. Now, I'm not a Republican in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with some Republican platform, but I'm not a Republican. But I can't watch Morning Joe. But my wife watches it. I can't wait. That show just makes me so fucking crazy. But this morning, so Trump's on, and he gave a speech last night, and he was talking about, like, the late night talk show host. And because I guess they were frying him, and he was saying they're not any good anymore. And he's like, let's bring back Johnny Carson. And what he meant was, you know, let's go back to that type of comedy, whatever. Scarborough goes, there's a president wondering why we can't bring a dead man back. And he's like, no, that's not what he was doing.
Yeah,
and you
no,
know that's not what he was
sometimes
doing. And you know that's not what he was doing. And I just it, and every day you're
it's
so,
just theater sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's like weird because they
not
put
even
out
good
this
theater.
Yeah, it's like they put out this like concerned persona, like, I'm so worried. I'm so worried about this. I'm so worried about that. It's like, be worried about the fact that we give tons of money to people to drop bombs on
yeah
other countries.
Yeah.
It's like, be concerned about that.
Well,
like, I don't think it's a coincidence that all this Diddy stuff is happening while Israel is starting a war in Lebanon.
Well, wait, and, how do you think that's related?
Oh, I'm just saying, like, people put out news to distract from other news. It's like all of a sudden, what are you seeing on the internet, on Twitter and stuff? You're seeing, did he touch Justin Bieber when he was a kid? Like, you're seeing like all these videos that are like, go look at celebrity pop culture right now. Like, don't look at the fact that we're giving all of our money to Israel to bomb Lebanon. And like, I'm Jewish and have like Israeli family. It's like, it's not like safe for them. It's not like a good situation for them over there, but it also is very hard.
Nothing to see here. Don't look at
It's very hard for us as Americans, I think, to have seen like the ignoring of humanitarian crises and then also us just pushing Ukraine into this war with Russia more and like basically like Noam Chomsky, the goat, like manufacturing consent. Like it's just all of this is like, oh, before the war with Russia and Ukraine started, they made us think Russia was really bad for years and years and years. They made us think Russia is terrible so that when this happens, we're like, oh my gosh, of course they would do this. Of course.
Right.
And like, I don't think Ukrainians should die. I don't think Israelis should die. I don't think Palestinians should die. I don't think Russians should die. Like, I'm against war. And it's just like, we'll never be done with war because people keep making money off of it and people keep retaliating for things that happened years ago. And then they're retaliating for things that happened for the retaliation. And then they're retaliating for that. And then America's like, we have to save the day. Like, if we're not strong, then nobody's strong. Like, imagine if we just let all the countries run wild. But then meanwhile, like,
well, that's how we
have our hands in every coup across like the world, and like our military has bases in almost every single country in the world.
America forgets that there was a world before America.
Yeah, for sure.
like we got here because there was a world before us, but that's so far gone. Are you worried about AI?
Not really.
For writing?
No, I'm not really. I think people are going to get to the point where they're tired of like this garbage, just like base culture that like we have created that is like, oh, every song on TikTok has an AI song. It's like people like artists because artists are interesting.
Right.
And there's been a like, it's more unsettling, like the lack of independent media than it is like the coming of AI. Because like AI can't create original ideas. They could copy already created ideas, but they're never going to create something that is better than the original thing. So like, I do think there's a worry that like AI will create derivative art and people will think that's good.
That's what I think will happen.
But being a comedian is like, you go to a room and you're face to face with people and you're connecting with people and you're a human and you thought this, you're a human, you have lived experience. Like when you watch a film, you don't want to just watch something that's like, all right, now there's a chase scene and then it goes into a car chase and then there's people crying because somebody died. And it's like, isn't this a great movie? Like, yay. It's like, why are they fighting? Like, what is the reason why they're fighting? What are these people's pasts? And like, those things are original and come from humans.
Right.
And it's like, AI will never be a better actor than a human acting because the job of an actor is to be realistic and is to say the lines in a way that like creates truth.
But here's where I might add to the argument.
Yeah.
I think number one, AI is going to bring a resurgence in live performance because 100%. That is the one thing it can't do. I'm not 100% sure that AI is not going to be able to create an actor that, that will be able to tell the difference of in a movie. But I know that it's not going to be able to create a Jordan on stage telling jokes.
Oh, for sure. I'd be more worried about like porn stars, to be quite honest. They could just make somebody with big tits and tell the AI to show their tits and make it seem like they're streaming, but they're not really streaming. It's just an AI that just shows you their tits and their digital tits made from thousands of pictures of tits on the internet.
That's the name of your next special, Digital Tits.
Digital
Tits, that's the name.
But I'm not too worried about AI. I think there are definitely...
You don't have to because it can't do what you do.
For sure. There are definitely aspects. Like, honestly, I just think of AI as doing the stuff that we hate and, like, the really monotonous work, which, like, sucks because, like, the monotonous work is kind of some of the only work that some people can do, you know,
right.
Like some people have skills outside of the workforce and they're like, I want to do one thing on an assembly line, or I want to do one job and just go home and have enough money from that.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, I feel for that, but like also
don't, because they're going to get a universal basic income.
I hope so. I hope so. That's what I really think the future should be, especially with AI, especially with all of the data that we give to the government and stuff of that nature. I think that's more like what AI is going to do, is like, it's going to go through databases very quickly. It's going to be able to make certain things very quickly. It'll be able to give you very generic things very quickly,
right?
Which are things that most people don't want to do. So right. Maybe it gets rid of some assistants,
right?
You know, like it's like stuff like that. But like, once again, do you know an assistant who likes their job? Like, I feel like most assistants are like, fuck my boss. Like, they make me do shit all the time. And they don't pay me more. It's like truck drivers. Like, that's not a great way of life. Like, it's a great way of life if they're getting paid well.
Right.
And like, there is a romanticism to the open road and like being free to just go and see America. But also on the other end, like, you get back issues. Your diet is terrible.
Yeah. You never see your family.
So yeah, I think like if we're shifting into jobs that like make more sense for us, like we're always going to need people to build houses. Like, we don't have AIs that could build a house yet. Like, we're always going to need,
I think
we're always going to need handyman. We're always going to need,
we're going to 3D print the houses, aren't we?
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
God, you date?
I currently am in a relationship of around 6 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is comedy hard for that?
Definitely.
Do you joke about your relationships? 'Cause I haven't
heard. I joke about my relationship a little bit. Nothing like about my girlfriend being a bad girlfriend or something like that, because she's a great girlfriend.
That's awesome.
Shout out Rena.
6 years and 30. Is it time?
We're going to see. Right. I wouldn't like to spoil anything on a podcast, but
fair enough.
She has definitely struggled with like the lifestyle of a comedian and like the need to be out. And she works a 9-to-5, so when it comes to
stuff. You need
stuff,
one of those. Well, now you do too, kind of. Well, not really.
No, because like I like work most mornings, and then I also work like nighttime events.
Oh, okay.
So like my day job has actually not been very convenient for comedy, because I have to work a lot of Fridays and Saturdays.
Right.
Do
you try jokes out on her?
Not too much. She's not a huge fan of my comedy. It's not her style.
That's so funny.
She's more into storytellers and like kind of immigrant communities who do like more act outs and
right.
stuff like that. Like, those are more her vibes.
But so my wife's not a big giant fan of my music either.
yeah.
And I have this running, it's a running joke on here, but it really happened that I was practicing one time and she literally vacuumed underneath me while I was practicing. But she's also, because she's a critic of mine, she's great to go to when I want like honest advice.
Oh yeah.
I did this thing called the Lifted Project this year, and it was basically like a We Are the World for the Hudson Valley, and I got like 38 musicians, and we sold out an airport, and we did an original song of mine, and we highlighted four nonprofit partners, and it was, and without a rehearsal, like the show was watching us learn the song and do it. So I came up with the idea. I invite the musicians, and the musicians all say, yeah, but now I got to write a song. So I write a song, and because I know my wife doesn't necessarily like all my music, I go to Trish, is this a good song? And she's like, no, that's really bad. But it was good, because then she made me write one that you know, was better.
Oh, yeah, but for sure. The harshest critics are good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, you want your fans to always be happy, because, like, they like your stuff. So,
yeah.
Like, if they don't like it, then, like, you're probably doing something wrong. But it's also good to have the roughest critics give you, like, if the roughest critic likes something, then you're like,
then you're
all right,
okay.
Then that's pretty universal.
Yeah, exactly.
That's something that was actually a good mark right there.
Right. Anybody ever steal any of your jokes?
Like, you do a lot of open mics. I've probably stolen jokes from other people without realizing it.
But if you don't realize it, that's not
for
stealing,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, it's just like you'll see something on TikTok from somebody, and you'll be like, "Oh, that's funny. You were going to my shows when I was telling these jokes. You used to come out and do my shows, and now this clip is on TikTok, and it's the same exact concept of my joke."
Mm.
And I'm thinking to myself, like, we both could have thought of the idea, like, parallel, but also, I'm probably told this joke in front of you probably 2 to 3 times. Mm. But also, like, I was in New Orleans for 4 years. It's like, if I picked up a joke from New Orleans that somebody said at a random open mic while I was drunk, and then it sounds like a good idea to me, like, 6 years later.
Right.
Like, unless somebody calls me out on it and says, like, that's so-and-so's joke, or, like, I don't remember where I got the joke from. That's also why, like, you try to get everything kind of from the organic process of, like, oh, like, I dropped my phone and the screen cracked. Like, that, whatever I say about the cracked screen is inspired by what I think in the moment, or right. something like that. Like, oh, my girlfriend broke up with me and I thought of this joke based off of the experience. Like, I think if you know the lineage of the joke, then you know that you kind of wrote point. It, you know?
That's a good point.
Like, oh, I was at a, yeah, I'm not going to say the example of the joke because I don't want to, like, stir a pot that doesn't need to be stirred. I decided already to take it out of my special, so I'm not going to tell it. Because, like, I don't know. You don't want people coming and being like, oh, that's a good joke, but so-and-so has the same exact joke. And then them being like, oh, you probably took it from that guy because he's bigger.
Right.
But
it's yeah. so hard. At, like,
even open micers in the New Jersey scene, like, they'll be riffing something on stage and then they'll say something that I say and I'm like, I know you're taking that from me, like,
right.
the way that I say that joke.
Do you ever say anything about it?
No. I don't really call people out unless I saw something that was, like, really malicious. And, like, I don't know. I've been doing comedy a long time, so I'm, like, confident in myself.
Right.
I don't need to justify myself to people.
It's hard, though, because – and it's kind of the same thing with music, although –
Also, if you're doing jokes at an open mic and then somebody – like, you tell a joke that you think is great, you think it's hilarious, and then people don't laugh at the open mic, then chances are it's unoriginal or you might have lifted something from somebody else, you know? Because right. they're like, oh, yeah, that joke's really funny, but so-and-so did it. Like, the amount of times that people are doing prior jokes and think that they're, like, talking about something really creative
right.
and it's just, like, exactly copied from, like – a special that's already been out for right. years.
But yeah. do you find it's in I think in comedy it's even harder though not to overlap. Like there's only so many premises.
For sure. I think that's kind of why you have to be true to yourself and who your persona is.
That's a really good point. If, like, you know the lineage of the joke, then you didn't steal it.
And it's being a student of the game, you know? Like, I haven't been as great as possible, like, since I started doing comedy. But, like, when I started doing comedy for the first 3 to 5 years, I was watching literally everything that came out. Like, I was watching YouTube clips all the time. I was watching all the specials that were on Netflix or HBO or whatever. So it's like, if you're not a student of the game, like, you're going to miss stuff, you
right.
know? And right. it's disrespectful to the art. To
right.
like not study it and not give like the past due diligence and just be like, oh yeah, I saw this person and then I didn't research anything else and I think I'm hot shit because I'm saying these jokes.
Right.
It's like we're all copying somebody except what is personal to us and what we're pulling from our own lives.
Yeah.
You know, it's very rare that somebody has such a unique way of talking that they are an original stand-up. Like, outside of that, like, the content is what makes you original, and then your delivery is either Borscht Belt or it's, like, the Kings of Comedy or it's, like, the Blue Collar Comedy Tour or it's, like, there's all these subsects of, like, comedy that have happened over the years.
Right.
So it's, like, oh, like, everybody's trying to be Joe Rogan and Kill Tony now.
Right.
And it's like, you see all these people who are trying to be, like, edgy or offensive, but it's like, they're all, like, derivative of Joe Rogan and Kill Tony. So they're
right.
just copying kind of shock stuff or political commentary that's already been said.
It's already out there, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
if you're like, oh, like, this sounds like a joke that a professional comedian would say, it's like, that's not always the right answer, you know?
Right.
Like, is this a joke that I, Jordan Freed, would say? Jordan Freed, the character. Jordan Freed, the idea. Like, if you have every special that I release over the course of my life and I am dead, what did I say and what did I stand for according to this? Is it all satire? Is it half truth? Is it this? Is it that? And I would like to say that most things come from a kernel of truth and grow into a plant, kind of.
Right.
And there's some stuff that's like legit exactly how it happened. I am telling you a story that is how it happened, but most of it is like, ah, this thing happened. I'm going to take something that I thought in the moment. There's truth because I thought it.
Right.
Even if it didn't happen to me, there's truth in that I thought of it happening to me.
Right.
And stuff like that.
Do you so in music, and tell me if this is true in comedy, in music, there's a difference between being able to write a good 12 songs and being able to put on a good concert. And I imagine with comedy, it's the same thing. There's a difference between being able to put together an hour of good jokes versus putting on a good show.
Oh, yeah. I'd say the show is all about the memory. And I'd say that's unique for – or similar for both music and comedy. Like your goal is to create a memory and an interesting experience regardless of what the material is. You know, you could be playing Bob Dylan covers, but it's you playing Bob Dylan covers. So it's your job to be interesting and take the Bob Dylan covers and make them your own, or it's just derivative and like not that good. But I would say like – with comedy, you could have great jokes, but you have to see what's in the moment. Sometimes it requires you to be more improvised. Sometimes it requires you to be more on script. Sometimes it requires you to be faster. Like if you're doing a TV gig, you got to be like on. Everything has to be tight. You have to have the script ahead of time. But if you're doing a club gig, you have to do whatever the crowd wants.
Right.
You know, if you tell a joke about sex and they're not liking it, then you have to go tell a different joke. If you tell a joke about politics and they don't like it, then you got to shift quickly. Like.
Right.
You got to move all the time. I tell vegan jokes, and those are very polarizing.
I think vegan jokes are hilarious. I think, too, it's about
Shout out Moonburger. I'm probably going to hit Moonburger after this.
There you go. And for me, like even watching – I don't perform comedy, but even watching comedy, and the same with concerts, it for me, it's the difference of where I was when I got there versus where I am when it's over. If I feel like – I feel like you moved me – If you didn't leave me in the same spot, to me that's good.
100%.
Yeah. And then, but
it has to be a show.
Yeah, there has
to be a show of
and musicians,
it. Yeah.
Musicians, not so many comedians do that, but musicians constantly forget it's a show.
And
you know, just get into the music and just play. And that's part of the reason why I don't resonate with like classical music.
It's very straight up. Yeah, there's not a lot of personality.
Yeah, and once I've seen you play the violin for a minute and a half, I get what that is. There's nothing else. And the space in between the songs. I like classical music when I'm listening to it. I just don't like going to it. But the other advantage I think musicians have over comedians is if you come to a John show and you cry – that's good. If you come to a John show and you laugh, that's good. If you come to a John show, but comedians, you guys have to be so much better because you only have that one track. I had to have laughed.
There is and there isn't for sure. I think there is an aspect to were people paying attention. If people aren't laughing, were they paying attention? Do they have smiles on their face?
Right.
And then outside of the do they have smiles on their face, is it interesting?
Right.
Are you telling like stories or jokes or concepts that at least make people think if they're not laughing?
Are you okay with just making people think?
I think I just resigned to the fact that people might not react to my jokes in the way that I want them to react. And I don't know if they'll always laugh at the jokes.
Right.
Like, not every joke is for everyone, but I hope if the joke is not for everybody, it's interesting.
Well, to your,
and people try to dissect it if they don't get it, and they're like, wait, why did he say that? And then it's like, oh, I missed the joke,
right.
Or, oh, there is humor behind that. Like, even thinking of, like, it being on Spotify, like, after I make this special and putting it out on Spotify and stuff like that, like, I just want people to be able to listen to it for 30 minutes to an hour. Like, I want them to stay till the end.
Right.
Or pick jokes that they – or tracks that they like and then send them to their friends. Like,
right.
If I put it on YouTube because nobody wants to buy it from me, like, I just hope people watch it and they stay till the end because interesting enough.
I don't know the business. Rogan argues that YouTube is the place to do it on.
Yeah, but he has a lot of followers, so it's very hard to get followers at this point if you don't already have them. Like, the algorithm is very tied. Like, I'll put up videos and they'll get, like, on a good day, like 40 thumbs up, and then it'll be like 200 views. And I'm just like, it has 40 thumbs up. Why aren't you putting it into the algorithm more? People are liking this, you know?
Right.
But unless you have like so many people following you and you put up stuff all the time, you're not really getting into those algorithms. If you put it up on YouTube, everybody could watch it, and everybody has the YouTube app on their phone. They all have it on their computer. They all have it on their TVs. So I think accessibility-wise, that is the best place to go.
But monetization, it's not?
They don't let you monetize unless you have a certain amount of people watching and subscribing.
Like, oh, okay.
Even if you have the subscriber threshold, you need to have the watch hours threshold. So people need to watch it like 80 hours a week or something like that.
Right.
So you have to have literally people watching you every week and be like that household in that regard. Like, you have to be that relevant. So I don't know. I've never gotten into the monetization of YouTube since they cut off everybody being able to monetize.
Right.
I got monetization when YouTube started and when YouTube was young and when they started doing the monetization, like I got those pennies or whatever.
Yep.
But then they just got rid of that because I didn't think they wanted to do the accounting or something like that.
Right.
And they just want to benefit the Mr. Beasts of the world who are getting billions of dollars from YouTube.
Yeah.
Or however much, probably $200 million from YouTube.
You like social media?
No, not really. I used to like it. I'm on it a lot for comedy, but if I wasn't promoting shows, I would probably try to stay away from it. In general, like, it sucks because it's like that is the new business card. It's like you have to tell people your social media and say go there, and like that's probably how they will get in contact with you,
right?
But yeah, as somebody who kind of grew up before social media into social media, it just feels very lifeless. Like, I know a time before it, so I know like people used to just go to bars and just meet people at bars, like. People used to just be friendly and try to have conversations.
Right.
And I think this is even something working at the Williams Center where I'm like at the front desk sometime, or I'm just hovering around and people come in and I give them tours of the building and have conversations about their hopes and dreams, ask them where they're from. Like, there's so much information about strangers to get. And I think social media definitely isolates us and kind of gives us this like feedback loop that we want. Like, maybe you're seeing like the same five people on your Instagram, but like you're not really meeting new people and stuff like that.
Right.
And then also, like, even on the end of the spectrum where you're like, but social media could be a job. Like, social media, like, marketing is how you promote your event. But now everything is so saturated and there's so many people paying for ads that, like, if you pay for ads, like, you're probably getting outbid unless you're putting down, like, thousands of dollars.
Right.
So, like, social media is now just so corporatized that you have to pay to play. Otherwise, your stuff doesn't really get seen, you know?
It's – yeah. Yeah.
It's like, oh, you could have gotten famous from YouTube like 15 years ago, but you can't get famous from YouTube now because you're going to try to push your stuff and people already have people that they watch on YouTube. Like, they're not looking for new stuff to watch on YouTube. They already have all their stuff.
Right.
They're not looking for new TikTokers. They already have their TikTokers. And then also all of these platforms are made so that nobody makes a bulk of the money. They're made that you're yesterday's news by tomorrow.
Right.
Like, they're literally made that everybody could be a star for 5 minutes. And it's like, average people could be stars. If average people could be stars, then anyone could be a star, and then no one's a star. And that's what they want. They want no one to be a star so that they have power over the celebrities to not pay them. They have power to not pay actors. They have power to not pay people to make a TV show. They're like, I'll just make money from this. Like, I'm not going to put commercials on TV, so I'm not going to pay commercial actors. I'm just going to have somebody do a TikTok. I'm going to get an influencer and give them a bunch of free stuff. Think about how much money has been lost in our economy because influencers are getting free shit from businesses.
Right.
Because the influencers are like, oh yeah, I'll post it on my story and you'll get so many followers. I'm sure that almost never works, like getting new followers from an influencer.
Right.
But so many people have gotten free stuff. Like, it's just evaporating worth.
Right.
Like,
right.
The same way that, like, a lot of corporations and billionaires don't circulate their money And it's like they have a monopoly on money and it's not in circulation. It's right. like, oh, yeah, Elon Musk is a billionaire going on a trillionaire, but he doesn't actually spend his money.
Right.
Like all of his money is tied up in stock. Like, oh, these people have money in trusts that aren't being spent. So it's like, oh, you guys are so rich, but you guys are keeping at least 50% of your billions of dollars like – cordoned off,
right.
whereas like if you gave me $2,000 extra, I'd spend that in a week. I have so many things I need to pay for with $2,000 extra.
Right.
Like the average people could split up all of the billionaire's money and have infinite amount of things that they need to catch up on.
Right.
You know, but these people have enough money, so they're not spending it. They spend it on also luxury goods that are just like not really helping the economy.
Right, right.
It's like, oh, you guys keep a luxury business in business for 5 years and then it goes under because you guys choose another luxury business and move your money away from it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. And it's tricky because you want a system where you want a system where you can do that, but you also want a system where you can't.
Yeah, it's like if I had $100 million, I would probably be wise and not spend $80 million of those dollars.
Right. And wait till and you don't have children yet?
No.
Wait till you have children. Then you're like, yeah.
I need that much money, yeah.
Yeah,
their college is going to cost a mil. Like, this is going to cost a mil.
My daughter's going to college next year. It's like I'm not going to be able to handle that. I only have one daughter, but I'm like really attached, and like I'm canceling the show next year because I'm going to need 1 year just to recover. it's going to suck so bad. College is a C word at my house right now.
Yeah.
So then the real path I think then is back to live performance, because that's the one thing that can't be emulated. It's the one thing where you can build a following and not have the influence of social media on top of you. So that's it's one thing the AI can't do. So that's probably the path, right?
Yeah, and our society is probably doomed if people don't want to see live entertainment, because they're basically going to kill live entertainment if they don't support the people who are the artists.
Right.
You know, if you don't buy their tickets, then they don't get to perform in the local area because word gets out that they can't draw.
Yeah.
So it's like you're hurting art and artists by not going to those shows. Like,
right.
Also, people pay $2,000 for Taylor Swift tickets. That's like 200 local shows that you could have went to and supported local artists who need your $10 as opposed to this person who doesn't need your $2,000.
Yeah. Yeah, but then I'm like, yes, I agree. But then I'm like, okay, but that happens not just in the arts. Like I could be,
oh yeah,
I could be the president of Kia, like an expensive car, and I could say, yeah, you're spending all that money on Mercedes, and that could be 10 Kias. But then that's not kind of on Kia to say, okay, I got to find my groove too.
For sure, I think there are I think it becomes like ethical and moral, though, more so. It's like, what businesses do you want to support? What are important businesses to keep alive in America?
Right.
Like, for example, that's why people would be like, buy a Ford. Support Ford because they're an American car company,
right.
And like, you want to keep people's jobs. Like, who cares if another country can make the jobs cheaper? They have slave labor, like stuff like that. But outside
like,
of that.
But then, like, with the arts, like, I struggle with the arts being market proof. Like
they're not.
But I know a lot of artists who feel they should be. Like,
oh yeah,
like the NEA, National Endowment for the Arts. I'm like, okay, look, no, your job is to be good enough to get paid. It's like, just because you're an artist doesn't mean you're entitled to. There's no other business except for farming where, you know, you say just because I have a podcast, I should get a basic income. There's no other business like that. But I know artists who think, no, you know, you got to support the arts. And people do. Maybe more people like CSI than like John Burton folk music on a stage. That's up to John Burton to figure out. I shouldn't get a grant for that. I don't know. What do you think?
I think art should be subsidized to some extent. Like, I think there should be grants available for people who apply for them and stuff like that.
But then now you're making it market proof, though, right?
Oh, yeah. No. I think that it's not market proof, but I think it should be market proof.
You think it should be?
Yeah, 100%.
Just arts or?
I think arts and journalism. Like, I think there should be
journalism.
Government money paid for journalism. Like,
ooh, but then then journalists answer to the government.
Not necessarily. I think like NPR reports on random like art stuff.
Right.
Well, NPR, I'm sure there is some aspect that is there is somebody pulling the strings, right. But I do think generally like PBS just plays good documentaries.
And NPR and PBS are my example though, because those are like NPR competes against media conglomerates, but they found a niche.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
And they did it. So it can be done. You just gotta work.
Yeah.
But the other hard part about the arts, which I am not taking into account, is like artists have like day-to-day needs that have to be met, and if meeting your day-to-day needs, meeting your financial needs on a day-to-day basis takes so much time that you don't have the time to get good enough at your art to have it support itself, well, that sucks.
Yeah. So also,
that should be endowed then.
Yeah, like you do a comedy show where you're paid $300 and you're like, wow, that's pretty good. You got paid $300 for a comedy show, but then you think about it and you're like, well, it took me probably 20 hours of thinking. Probably 40 hours of going up to open mics for this material. And then you're like, wow, that's already 70 hours that I got to make $300. That's not a good deal anymore.
Right. Right.
You know?
Right.
So I would say like even musicians, like it's like they have to think of the songs. They have to practice the songs. They had to have played their whole life before they got creative so that they're good enough to have ideas and make ideas.
And then with not so much with comedians, but with musicians too, like even like just the day of rate is ridiculous. To play a 3-hour show, you got to get there an hour and a half early to set up. You got to tear down for an hour and a half. And then you have travel time. And all of a sudden your 3-hour show is an 8-hour show that you're getting your $300 for. And forget all the practice and that other stuff. So, yeah, that sucks. Do jokes come to you randomly?
Yeah, for sure.
How do you catch them?
I just have a notepad in my phone. I use a couple different apps.
What, like Notepad's one of them?
I use the Notes on Apple, and I've been using that since 2010, like 2009, I think.
Nice.
I have comedy notes from like that long ago.
Have you ever printed them all out?
No. And then I also have this notes app, Ulysses, that's kind of more word processing and is good for like blogging and like writing fiction, and like you could even write screenplays on it. So I kind of subscribe to that and keep all of my stuff in that cloud now. Like my entire special is on Ulysses.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Do you handwrite at all or no?
Yeah, I handwrite sometimes. Like I like to keep all my jokes generally handwritten, like code words when I'm like learning my material.
Right.
Like I'll basically learn it in my brain, but then I'll be like, oh, this is the dandelion joke. Like it's like, and I know what the dandelion joke is, but it just says dandelion, and it's just reminding me, make sure you say the dandelion joke.
Right.
Like it's not like writing it all out.
It's a set list.
Yeah.
For a musician. Yeah.
But yeah, when I'm like sitting down and being creative, I'll write it out long form sometimes, especially if I like don't know exactly how the joke's going to work, or if it's a complex joke where it's like, oh, this isn't just going to be easy setup and punchline. Like there's some stuff that like I've thought of in my life, I write it down and I never have to look at it ever again.
Right.
But then there's sometimes where I'll tell jokes on stage and I'll be like, that's not really working. And then I'll watch a video from a long time ago and I'm like, oh, that's why it's not working, because you have to tell it this way.
Right.
Like I went back to it and I was like, I had three more tags that I haven't been saying. That's why people don't like this joke.
Right, right.
Is like I took out the funny parts because I forgot the three other funny parts that I came up with for it.
Yeah. See, that's kind of an advantage that a musician has, that a comedy's harder. Is like once you start a song, at least the song part of being a musician, once you start a song, it's pretty hard to forget the good parts.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a comedian, like you can tell, you can have a premise and you have a 3-minute premise, and but you only remember a minute and a half of it. You can still get away with that. Like musician, you can't. But we have the luxury of having it being framed in a song, so we almost can't forget it.
For
but,
sure.
But it's harder for you guys.
Yeah. Also, music is how we remember things. Emotion is how we remember things. So
yeah,
it's like if something makes me laugh in my head, and then it's like, that was funny. Ha ha ha. Like the emotion is tied to it and stuff like that. Or the excitement of coming up with an idea sometimes helps me remember it.
The way my head works is if I don't handwrite it, if, because I type pretty fast.
Yeah.
But then I think, all right, if I don't handwrite it, I'm not spending enough time on it. I'm not getting as much out of it as maybe I would if I handwrote it, because I fucking, because I, it, it just slows down your thinking when you handwrite. And then I have more, like when I'm typing lyrics, I don't have time to go back and rework it, or I'm on to the next lyric. But when I'm handwriting it, I can be like, I'll be 3 seconds and only be halfway through a line before I go, oh wait, no, it needs to go that way.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But the disadvantage of that is, so I have like, I work in composition notebooks.
Yeah.
Dude, I've got like three piles that are three feet deep. For me to go back and find shit, it's a, like, at least on a phone, it's easy to you know, keyword and search for words and stuff like that. But like with a composition notebook, I'm fucked. So that sucks. That part of it does suck. What's filmmaking? Do you want to pursue that as well, or are you?
For sure. Yeah? I see myself directing films down the road again. And getting back into some screenplays that I have. That was the ultimate goal of stand-up, was to people be like, you're really funny. Do you have any scripts you're working on? And me be like, yeah.
As a matter of fact.
Here, sell this to some dude.
Right.
Like, get it packaged with some stars. Like,
you have
put me in it.
Do you have representation?
I just have a commercial agent now. So I don't have a literary agent or a theatrical agent.
Literary agents are tough.
Yeah.
That's tough to get. Yeah. And you book yourself?
Occasionally, yeah. What do you mean, with comedy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah. I book myself for comedy.
I shifted gears.
Yep. Self-produce most shows. Like, other people will put me on shows, and it's, like, through connections that I've made over the years that
right.
I hit people up, and I'm like, yo, you got any shows? Like, I'm trying to
right.
trying to work this right now.
Moving along.
Yeah.
Beautiful. All right, the name of the special is?
When the Edible Hits, and it is going to be the feeling of when the edible hits. It's going to be euphoric, it's going to be hilarious, it's going to be weird, and it's at Sesh House Social in Kearny, New Jersey at 155 Midland Ave. Tickets are only $15. Check it out. I'd love to have some Hudson Valley people in the crowd, because the Hudson Valley is my home. I was originally going to shoot it in Rosendale.
Oh, yeah.
At Stepping Stone, but yep. They're kind of going through a transitional period right now, because I think they're growing to you guys.
Yep.
I think they're coming to Kingston.
Yep.
So he was kind of wrapped up with that, so we made the transition to do it in Jersey, where I live right now. But I'm super excited about all the growth that's happened in the Hudson Valley, and I love coming back, and my parents still live in the Hudson Valley, so
beautiful,
it's awesome,
man.
To be here.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for coming, man.
Thank you. Really, this was an awesome podcast.
Before I let you go,
yeah,
you used to teach podcasts. What am I doing wrong?
You got a great setup in here. There's a lot of soft material in the room. You're very good at listening to your guest and adding to your guest. I'd give you an A.
Seriously?
Yeah, you'd pass.
Oh, man, smoke. All right, I'm out on that note. Thank you so much. And thanks for coming and driving, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
All thanks. Right, man. That was home from here. Oh, thank you, man.
That was awesome.
You good?
Did yeah, I'm chilling.
Everything?
No, that was good.
All right.
Yeah, no, we talked a lot about Santa. That was good.